morning.
Good morning.
Well, nice to see you all. I was walking over here, and there was really loud rock music coming from across the lake. Oh, good. That's good for meditation. Then I saw thousands of people running on the other side of the lake. So I just thought it would be nice to think about if all of us could take into our hearts the experience of all these people together, and some of them are feeling elation, struggle. Some of them are feeling doubt, pain. Some of them are feeling better than other people. Some of them are feeling like they're not good enough. So they've chosen to go somewhere where all the most vivid aspects of being a human being are really strong. And they're doing it together. And, of course, these are all things that we all get to experience, I suspect. And one of the nice things about sports is that they show us that we are not alone with those strong feelings. But that doesn't have much to do with my topic for today. So the topic that I have is retreat and engagement. So a friend of mine recently had just done maybe her first retreat or her first long retreat here. And when we do retreats here, we come together and spend a half a day or a full day or several days. We don't speak. We spend most of the time doing sitting meditation. And we do everything else that we do with a mind of meditation. And it's a really central part of our practice here. It's really what Tim, our guiding teacher, emphasizes most. We do them every month. And they're quite wonderful. So this friend that I was talking to had just done one of her first retreats, and I asked, you know, how did it go? And she said, come on in. There's seats. She said, I feel so grateful. It was the main thing I feel is grateful to have done that retreat. And she talked about just quieting down so much while she was there. And feeling really safe and protected. She said she felt very safe and protected. She was sitting right next to Tim, our guiding teacher, and Rosemary, our associate guiding teacher. Felt this great sense of care and safety. And then she came home, and there was enormous emotional turmoil and difficulty in her family. People were suffering a lot. And she observed that she was able to just sit next to these people who are suffering and just be with them. And some of them are people, she said, that don't really respond well to if you try and get into their business or even if you try and draw them out. And that's hard sometimes. But she was able to just sit there and be with them, be present to their suffering, show that she loved them without trying to fix anything or change anything. And this may seem like an odd model for engagement, to just be there. Doesn't seem like you're doing much. And it is certainly not the only model for engagement I'll talk about today. But it is a beautiful and important one. something like 10 years ago in South Africa, a nation where people had spent many years torturing and killing each other in absolutely unbelievably horrifying ways. They had something called the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions. And what they did is they just had people get together from both sides of these horrible circumstances who had years of hatred and violence. And they just spoke about what had happened. And they just listened. And that was it. And that was it. There was no justice. There was only presence. An absolutely astonishing achievement. Have you ever heard of anything like that on that scale? There is hope for humankind. So, this amazing Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was really, really effective at promoting peace and well-being in the country of South Africa, I will observe, was promoted by a fella, Nelson Mandela, who spent, I actually didn't look it up, 20 years in prison, 30 years in prison. Well, most people who go to prison don't think of it as retreat. But he made it a retreat. He was transformed. And he learned how to be present. The best place for a retreat is when you don't want to be there. In line at the grocery store is my favorite location for retreat. There's always something joyful there if you look. So, would you do me a kindness, please, and put the clock somewhere where I can see it? Wonderful, thank you. And there's a clear basis in the very roots of Buddhism for this idea of retreating and engagement. The Eightfold Path, in my opinion, essentially being making a commitment to alleviate suffering through kindness and meditation. If you boil it down, make a commitment to alleviate suffering through kindness and meditation. Engagement is kindness. Meditation is retreat. And of course, these things aren't different because when we meditate, our meditation is to be kind to what's here. And when we're being kind, we can bring the mind to meditation. But they are useful to see as different things as well as one thing. So this idea of engagement, kindness, which is right action, right speech, and right livelihood, and meditation, which is right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation, is right there in the most basic and central Buddhist teaching. I love this 17th century Chinese nun named Xingang. She wrote a poem called A Meditation Cushion. A single meditation cushion, and one is completely protected. Earth may crumble, heaven collapse, but here one is at peace. Sacred titles and worldly fame both fade away in the sitting, and the universe assembles on the tip of a feather. A single meditation cushion and one is completely protected. Earth may crumble, heaven collapse, but here one is at peace. Sacred titles and worldly fame both fade away in the sitting, and a universe assembles on the tip of a feather. Now, some of you already sat for 40 minutes, and you might think, not true! Meditation is quite various, is it not? 1 second to the next. Something new. But here Shingang is just giving us an encouragement. She's saying your meditation is a place you can come to be safe. People need to feel safe. Some of us feel unsafe more than others, and so we need this more than others. We need to feel safe. And when she talks about sacred titles and worldly fame both fade away in the sitting, that's her milieu of, it's her career. She's a famous nun who gets, like, you know, the emperor calls. We want you to receive a purple robe, and then you can do our bidding, or whatever. So that's what she's caught up in. So she's talking about her job, sacred titles and worldly fame. So this is our job. What's your job? They can fade away in the sitting. All the worldly affairs, that's the term usually used in this tradition, worldly affairs can fade away. As Dogen says in the Fukan Zazengi, put aside all involvements and suspend all affairs. It's one of the first instructions that he gives for Zazen. And a universe assembles on the tip of a feather. You actually see the connection of all things to this thing. That's a profoundly peaceful ground for engagement with reality. Connection. So I'll read a poem by Ryokan, a Japanese chap whose life spanned the 18th and 19th century. In my youth, I put aside my studies, and I aspired to be a saint. Living austerely as a mendicant monk, I wandered here and there for many springs. Finally, I returned home to settle under a craggy peak. I live peacefully in a grass hut, listening to the birds for music. Clouds are my best neighbors. Below a pure spring where I refresh body and mind, above towering pines and oaks that provide shade and brushwood. Free. So free. Day after day. I never want to leave. So a retreat can be really wonderful. I mean, he gave his whole life to retreat. Retreating from worldly affairs. It's funny, though, at the end, he says, I never want to leave. Ooh, Ryokan's got an attachment. Ryokan is real. Ryokan doesn't present you a vision of what should be. He says, this is what's here. And it's true. Sometimes you'll be on retreat, you'll be like, oh, I never want to leave. Isn't it funny, like, half the time when you're meditating, you're waiting to hear the bell ring, and the other half, you're like, oh, could this peace just never end? That's how we are. In another poem, Ryokan says, have you forgotten me or lost the path here? I wait for you all day, every day, but you do not appear. So sometimes retreat is really hard. This is a consistent theme. If you read any of the, you know, there's a long tradition of hermit monk poets in Zen. And they talk a lot about, you know, like in the previous poem, free, so free. All these just sense of enormous liberation, joyful engagement in simple tasks throughout the literature. But there are also these moments of loneliness, of difficulty. I think Stonehouse has a poem. He has like all these poems that are just about how great it is to be liberated in the mountains. And then he has one that says, don't think this mountain life is easy. And then he like lists, the old ladies come and steal my firewood, and the bugs eat my food, and there are rats running around on my house. So there's no magic solution. sometimes it's hard. And when we do retreats here, for most people, sometimes it's hard. Most people I know who've done a substantial number of meditation retreats have had at least one where they found themselves just sitting and crying at length, full bore, letting it go. It's common. Sales pitch, how am I doing? But when the mind doesn't have its normal material to chew on, like, how soon am I going to get there? When am I going to get this project done? How can I convince that person to be the way I want them to be? One of my favorites. They've actually done brain scans, and they'll see if you put a mind in isolation from external stimuli, it just starts, it still keeps doing all the things it does, but it has to make it all up. You know, so the visual cortex, like when I first started sitting, it would just be, you know, it was like, as one person said, it's like watching cartoons. I was, you know, watching the wall, it's like, wow, it's just a white wall, but Mickey Mouse! So the mind, it just, that's the way the brain and the mind functions. So what happens, it seems to me, is it tends to, you know, process through subconscious and unconscious conditioning that we have. And so if you have some suffering in you that you're missing all the time because you're running around, probably trying to avoid it unconsciously, you can't get away. And it comes out. But this is really good. Because then you don't have to carry it around unconsciously for the rest of your life. That's pretty good. We're never going to know all the unconscious stuff that drives us. And we're never going to know all the stuff that we've internalized and stuffed down into ourselves that causes us to suffer. But we can see some of it, and we can let a lot of it go just by sitting down for a while and letting the mind digest. And we have a lot of support for it. That's why Shingon has to say, one is completely protected. So we can feel safe. That's why we have a teacher. We can go up there and go, Tim! Ah! He goes, yeah, I know. So, we do formal intensive retreats here. So that's like our half day, 1 day. 2 day, 5 day, and 7 day retreats. We have one a month. They're all different. And then I would say that when we do meditation, when we sit zazen, many of us on a daily basis, or maybe some of you once a month, or maybe some of you think, that would be a good idea. I should try that. I concur. It is a good idea. You should try it. That's a retreat. That's a put aside all involvements and suspend all our prayers. And we can retreat to our breath anywhere we are. As I was saying, in the grocery line, there's always an opportunity to come back to just this. That's a kind of retreat. And, you know, this idea of retreating from worldly life is really central to the Buddhist tradition. It was the path laid out for his most dedicated followers by the Buddha and what he did, right? He was set up to be a prince. Sounds pretty sweet. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the impression, the records that you have suggest he was a pretty wonderful guy. So he could have been, you know, I think we got a pretty good prince, you know, Obama, he's pretty good. I won't get into that. He's pretty good. And you can have like a less good leader, right? There's a lot of leaders who have been less than good for the people around them. So he could have been probably pretty wonderful. But he chose to just let that go, devote himself to retreat. And then he recommended that for his followers. He also had lots of lay followers, and he said, well, you know, do this. You know, he had kind of a different way of teaching for them. But he really encouraged people to just completely leave behind all possessions, all worldly concerns, all family concerns, and completely retreat, which is different than what we're doing here, which is cool. Although he recommended this complete retreat, he spent his whole life engaging in conversations with people. That's all we actually pretty much we have for a record of Buddha's life. About 70% of it is just conversations that he had with people. And they were conversations that almost exclusively were people who were coming to ask him for advice, or sometimes to argue with him because they wanted to prove him wrong. He was very much engaged in the world. And in that culture, by having devoted himself so completely to this meditative path of retreat, he had an enormous authority to people because that was really valued in that culture. He was by no means alone in following that path, but people just thought he was very wise. So he was available. He was available. That's the impression I get. You know, he'd walk from town to town. He'd go in and beg for some food. He'd go sit somewhere on the outskirts of town, and people would come see him. And his friend Ananda would say, Buddha, you got a minute? He'd say, okay, well, come on in. And then we just have this big record of him conversing with people. And his teaching is sometimes complicated, sometimes simple. But pretty amazingly, relentlessly focused on the alleviation of suffering. So that's one way of engaging in the world, is just by teaching or conversing about how to be well. Conversing about how to be well. It's not clear what our practice here is in the U.S. of A. We're figuring it out, aren't we? I mean, is anyone here doing what Buddha did? Is anyone living on the outskirts of town and walking into town to go begging with your bowl? Okay. So no one's trying that. And, you know, what we're doing is different than has been done in any of the Asian countries to which Buddhism has migrated. So what we emphasize, a lay practice, and even those of us who are ordained as priests, our lives look like lay practitioners in most countries. People would be like, how can you be a priest and just go have a job? That's weird. So we're doing a practice that we emphasize doing all these practices of meditation, kindness, textual study, but then spending lots of time just being engaged in worldly affairs. Ooh. So, interesting. So we're kind of figuring this out. Figuring this out as we go. I want to talk a little bit more about Ryokan because he's pretty cool. So I read a couple of his poems before. He was an oddity, by the way, in that it was no longer at all normal in Japan to go around and live in the woods by yourself and just come into town and beg for food. That had like stopped being a normal practice long, long ago. And Buddhism was about priests and monks living in monasteries, and people would come and visit them there. So he was a total throwback. But he wrote all these poems. He's probably the most well-known poet in the Japanese language. Extremely beloved folk figure in Japanese culture. Widely known. And he was really known for being really humble. He didn't teach. He would visit his friends and his family, and they would give him, you know, ink and paper so he could do. He was a famous calligrapher as well as poet. And he'd just hang out for a while, have some fun, and then go back to his little hut. But he didn't teach people. There's this story where he had a nephew who was I've never found a record of what he was doing, but everyone in his family thought it was pretty bad. So I don't know. Do you know any 20-year-old guys who do any stuff that their family thinks is bad? Let's just imagine it's something like that. So, drinking, womanizing, I don't know. But people were upset, and he was kind of a prodigal. So he happened to visit. Ryokan was visiting at a family member's house, I guess probably his uncle's, and his nephew came back, and his nephew seemed pretty much set on just trying to shake down the family for some dough and get out of there and keep partying. And Ryokan, he wasn't a very talkative fellow, so, you know, he just kind of hung out. And then before this nephew was going to leave, he was getting ready to leave, and Ryokan was with him. And Ryokan came in and helped him tie his sandals. A very humble gesture. And then he wept. Then the nephew took off. And apparently the nephew, at that point, stopped. He really changed his life quite promptly thereafter. And I like this story because Ryokan is not skillful in this story. Nelson Mandela, when he set up the Truth and Reconciliation Committee, practiced skillful means. He thought of a way to make things better. He worked at it. He put it into place. Ryokan's not skillful. He's just sad. He's just watching someone suffer and create suffering, and he's sad. And he's just real with his nephew. But he's able to be real in this way because he spent his life in retreat, so he can be really humble. He doesn't have to feel defensive because he spent a lot of time feeling safe. And his nephew can be really touched by this because of the, maybe you call it moral authority, that comes from Ryokan's humility. Not from Ryokan's ability to tell you what to do or explain how things are or how you should be better, but just by his commitment to humility. And he's just there. He was just there with his nephew, not explaining anything, present. So there's this way of engagement that Buddha did that I call teaching. And then this is this way of just being present, compassionate, and wholehearted. That's kind of what I was talking about more at the beginning with my friend who'd come back from the retreat to her family who was suffering. So I've got another poem by Ryokan here about his means of engagement. First days of spring. The sky is bright blue. The sun huge and warm. Everything's turning green. Carrying my monk's bowl, I walk to the village to beg for my daily meal. The children spot me at the temple gate and happily crowd around, dragging to my arms till I stop. I put my bowl on a white rock, hang my bag on a branch. First we braid grasses and play tug of war. Then we take turns singing and keeping a kickball in the air. I kick the ball and they sing. They kick and I sing. Time is forgotten. The hours fly. People passing by point at me and laugh. Why are you acting like such a fool? I nod my head and don't answer. I could say something, but why? Do you want to know what's in my heart? From the beginning of time, just this, just this. Free, joyful. This is the promise of this tradition. Free, and joyful. And he's famous for this. There's lots of stories about Ryokan screwing around with kids or having drinks with woodcutters and farmers. Just being with people, having a good time. It's good to be with people and have a good time. So, that's a good way of engaging. Free and joyful. I feel like I've been... So it's not always true, but I've been at meetings at this place where we're talking about things that are kind of difficult. Maybe we have differing opinions, you know. And sometimes it's just like, it's still just free and joyful, you know. Sometimes we don't get stuck on our side or anything. We just have some laughs, get something done. It's not always true. But I've seen it. I've seen it manifest in this place. So in the early 60s, in Vietnam, there was a really horrifying war. And, you know, the land was being covered in mines and traps. So that if you went walking somewhere, you had no idea whether you'd be killed or horribly maimed. You know, people were just engaging in these incredibly unkind acts to each other all over the place. And Vietnam is kind of anomalously for Southeast Asia a Zen nation. But, you know, most of those nations have some type of Buddhism. It's the most common religious or spiritual practice. So anyway, Vietnam is a Zen nation, and there was a young Zen monk named Thich Nhat Hanh. And he, I think it was kind of a puzzle at the time what to do, whether they should just, you know, stay in their places of practice and cultivate peace and somehow model peace in that way, or whether they should just get out of there and start trying to fix things. And Thich Nhat Hanh set up a pretty amazing model for doing both, which I would argue really is, it seems to be the most clear model for how we are engaging in Buddhism in the United States today. He encouraged doing mindfulness and meditation practice and lots of other elements of traditional Zen practice. But he also founded a thing called the School of Youth Social Services. So, and they just organized people to build schools, provide medical care, rebuild villages that had been bombed, resettle homeless families, organize agricultural cooperatives. So they went out and they just saw that people were suffering and things were in disarray, and they just did stuff to... try and help people suffer less. And actually, I just remembered there's a nice precedent from this in the earliest Buddhist teaching. Someone, I can't remember the context, but there's a conversation. Someone asked Buddha about maybe they're going to go to some places where no Buddhist teachings have ever been received, and they say, well, how are we going to do this? I might be making that up. But anyway, he says, well, you know, normally we teach the Eightfold Path and the way from suffering to non-suffering. But first, you need to make sure people have food. So we're not going to bother. If people are starving to death, we start there. Find a way that people can eat. People need to have shelter. So if people don't have shelter, we have to start with that. And people need medicine. So we start with that. So... there's a nice precedent for this in the early teachings. So, this model for engagement
that Thich Nhat Hanh sets shows not being stuck on one side or the other between retreat and engagement, but really doing both in balance. Also not being stuck to one side of anything, because he got in a lot of trouble because he wouldn't take sides with either the North or the South Vietnamese, were the ones who were at war. And eventually he was exiled. And he didn't go back for a long time. I don't know if he's ever been back. Does anyone know if he's ever been allowed back to Vietnam?
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, good. Oh, good. That makes me happy. Thank you. So he's not stuck to one side. He's brave. He's brave. Well, if someone's running around, we don't even know. I can't even know how much bravery this takes. But all I can know is I wanna stand up inside it and do my best to be inspired by it. And you know, there's a lot of commitment. You'd think, I don't know, there's probably in here who've been burned out just trying to do their regular job. How easy would it be to get burned out trying to, you know, build burned villages in a place where people were just burning the next one down the road? But, you know, by having retreat, you can have some support for that. So, Tim, as I said, he emphasizes retreat practice a lot, which I think is cool. And if you haven't done a retreat and you're interested in doing one, feel free to come up afterwards and ask me about it. Or there are probably a lot of other people who'd love to talk to you about whether that seems like a good match for you. Or if you just have questions about it or whatever. So I wrote here, not to. Retreat and engagement are not to. That is, they're not. We talk about them as separate because that's useful. But in another sense, they are not separate things. As I've mentioned at a couple points, you can always retreat to the present moment. You say, well, that's not retreating, that's coming here. Okay, good. Coming here is retreating. So you can find this kind of safety, this kind of stillness, this kind of encouragement, just by bringing your attention here. Tim Burkett, our guiding teacher, my beloved teacher, he is also the head of a very large organization that provides services to the chronically and persistently mentally ill. And he told this story a while ago, so sorry if it's a repeat. See, it's getting really bad. Not only is Tim repeating his stories over and over again, now we're going to start repeating his stories over and over again. So, a lot of what he does is he lobbies at the Capitol to get funding, the Capitol of Minnesota, to get funding for his organization to provide services for people who are homeless and so forth. So, he was doing this, and I'm just going to tell his story as best I remember it. He said that he had to go in and try and talk to this legislator who wanted to cut funding for the kind of stuff he was doing, or maybe for his program, I don't know exactly. And so that's not very fun. You got to go and see someone who's trying to take away your money for something, you know, he feels passionate about. These people are suffering. So he's kind of, you know, he's not real happy with this guy. Like some of us, maybe he has some judgments about a class of people who think that there should not be government funding for services for this kind of people. So, you know, Tim's got his judgment, and he's not real happy about it. And he goes in there, and the guy's got this Bible sitting on the front of his desk. Are you familiar with Jesus Christ? Because I don't know that much about it, but he did say, what you do for the least of me, least of you, you do for me. Blessed are the poor. I thought that was the message of Christianity. But I don't know. I'm not an expert. That's the message I like of Christianity. Other people have different messages. Anyway, so he looks at this Bible. Come on, man, you want to cut funding for the poor, and you got this Bible here. So Tim's kind of, like me, he's getting all, getting a little competitive here. But he's done years and years of retreats. He's devoted himself to this practice for 40 years. And he's able, in that moment, to realize that he could retreat to this moment. And he just came back to feeling the feelings in his body, experiencing his breath, actually hearing what the person on the other side of the desk was saying. Can you imagine? Realizing through that retreat to this direct moment experience, his connection to this other human being. Just another person who believes in something, who's devoting their energy to it. And he was able to hear the person, make Tim, as I gather, his wholehearted effort to communicate why it would be good to provide money for these people who are suffering. Make his effort. Knowing that the results were out of his control, as are all results for all of us at all time, make his effort with his whole heart and let go. I'll just read you a poem by Ria Khan to end. Down in the village, the din of the flute and drum. Here, deep in the mountain, everywhere the sound of the pines. Just this. Well, I feel like I've said what I should say. I would love to hear people say things or ask things if you would like.
Every day I walk down Nicollet Mall, and there are lots of people out there, all kinds of people. There are kids. Some of those kids have kids. You know, they're there with their children. There are police security cameras here and there. There are cops. And there are a lot of homeless people there. There are some people who clearly, I say clearly, have problems with alcohol. I say clearly because they're staggering. So they're having trouble walking and they're carrying a cup. And there are other people who are regulars. I mean, they're there. Every day, I see them. There's a guy, kind of a long beard, long hair, and he's got some kind of gadget. I think it's a Game Boy or something. And he sits there for hours on this stone bench and just interacts with this thing. I've never seen him talk to anybody. And then, of course, there are other folks out there, and they generally have stuff stacked up besides them. There's one woman, whenever I see her, with her stuff stacked up beside her, has a notebook, and she's writing. There's another guy who, he's a busker, he sings gospel. And he's very cheery, very happy, very engaging with folks when they come by. I stop and talk with him occasionally. There's another older African-American woman there who, man, she's always arrayed in this these glorious clothes. I don't know, this like flowing veils and something wrapped around her head. And again, she's got several bags. And I see her almost every day, someplace on the street. And the other day, when I was walking past her, she was dancing. So, the mendicant life in the U.S. How many of these people, I don't know what their lives must be like, but, wow.
I don't know either.
I do know. I work for the Fire Emergency. Those are my patients. And we see more and more people like that. So over time, we used to see just poor people. But more and more people becoming poor. People who lose their house, their job, insurance. There's people flocking here from cities. Chicago, Gary, Indiana, Alabama. So I know these people. I take care of them. A lot of them are sick. A lot of them grew up in ghettos and they never knew about work and they were abused. It's a growing population.
I was an advocate for a client myself actually for a long time in the Bay Area and here and say that it's a real tough battle in all systems in general. They take the kids, they take your property, they take your lives. I shut the East Bay Hospital down in 1996 in California because three patients died in seclusion and restraint in a row. The last one was a mild fever infection and had been filed suit for wrongful death in the case of mild fever, two others. And we let a boycott shut that hospital down. God knows what the retaliation for all of that was. It must be a lot today. I think had I not published it, and I'm sure that by now, it becomes an urban stalking. That is, the labels that are used, the judgments that are made, have become devices to separate us from each other and institutional codes to make money with. There are more codes every year now, hoarding is a mental illness, for example. So it's likely to continue until we're all mentally ill.
Well, if we use the Buddhist model, that is the condition. Our life, as Buddha said, our life is shaped by our mind, and we all suffer. So, in this way, we're all connected. In this way, we're all connected. In all ways, we're all connected. So, let's not forget Ryokan's joyful engagement, though.
And he was not a... He was very revered and loved, and his poetry was sought after. So he had, that was his living. He traded that for his soul. So he wasn't like, it wasn't like the people who are. He was not a person who was discarded by his society. Correct.
That's absolutely true. No. He had a beautiful relationship with the world. That's what I'm talking about today. retreat and engagement, a beautiful relationship with the world. The form he took emphasized beauty because he emphasized poetry and calligraphy. But the relationship between loving engagement and making something beautiful and doing something kind is very close in my mind. So I think that's good. I think maybe we should turn things over to Laura.